If you're feeling like this week's weather is a shock to your system, imagine what it might feel like to your pet. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She takes some time once a month to come by and talk with us and has some great advice on keeping your pet healthy and happy. And Dr. Sandy, great to see you back.
It's nice to be here again.
We have that cold weather out there definitely settling in over the state. And as it snows in the north, let's talk about, are there some breeds of dogs? I mean, there are a lot of dogs that love it.
And there's some dogs that are just designed to be out in the cold weather. The northern breeds, you know, huskies, malamutes, and so on. But even those dogs still need shelter and things when it's really, really cold outside. And, you know, some important things to remember to do is, like, right now when the lakes are, you know, maybe up north especially starting to think about freezing and there's still open water, be so careful with your pets because we do see them run out onto the lake. They might see some geese or other, you know, ducks or something and take off and then fall through. And I've lost a couple of my patients that way with, you know, people not being careful out on the lakes. So be careful with that. And, you know, remember, there are some dogs that like to wear clothes and others that don't. But if your dog is more comfortable wearing a sweater, by all means, you know, keep something
put
like
one
that
on
them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't met too many dogs that like booties yet. But
I wondered about that. Do paws need protecting, really?
They do. I mean, especially when you start looking at all the different chemicals and salts and things that may be out there, they can be quite irritating to the feet. And the booties that I've had probably the most success with people saying, yeah, their pets really like them, they look like little balloons. They're kind of a rubbery type thing. They're quite inexpensive, and they slip on over the feet rather than actually being a boot that laces or, you know, does up some way. Dogs seem to like that. They have good traction with them. They're not slippery. That would be something to consider trying. But if your dog won't wear boots when they've come in from outside, check them for snowballs, wipe the feet down, wipe the belly down to get any of that antifreeze and salts and things that they could potentially ingest off your pet.
It's kind of interesting just jogging through my own neighborhood. You'll see dogs being walked, a lot of them in my neighborhood. And sometimes, depending on the weather, some of them look just miserable. They don't feel like they should be out there. And there's this need to balance. You got this need to balance exercise, but then not subjecting them to frostbite or whatever.
Yeah. And so it means making sure that your inside of your house is safe as well, watching things like candles burning. I had a fire in my fireplace the other day and brought in a bunch of firewood, and Pete, my new dog, ended up running off with a log someplace and was chewing on it. But, you know, thank goodness it wasn't one that was in the fire that could have really been a problem. But, you know, you have to be careful even, you know, with your pets inside and enrich their life when they're inside. New toys, games inside. Consider there's even, like in our area here, we have a couple of, you know, between doggy daycares, there's also a big kind of dog gym where they have agility equipment set up. And if you've got a dog that likes to do that kind of stuff, there's plenty of places like that available to keep your dog entertained.
Are there some signs that your dog might be suffering from a frostbite or other kinds of exposure?
Yeah, if you start looking at their tissues being cold to the touch, especially if they look pale, like ear tips or toes or anything like that, that's definitely time to be bringing them in and very gradually warming them up while you're on the phone to the emergency clinic to get them in, because they may need some assistance that way too. You don't want to plunge them into warm water and increase that blood flow to those areas. You need to do it a slow, gradual warm up so that the tissues can thrive.
You know, I have in my neighborhood an orange tabby and a black and white kitty that are outside all the time, it seems. And I know there are some cats spend their time outdoors. Mm-hmm. I'm not really in favor of it, but what should we keep in mind in the winter? Or are the cats smart enough to stay in, get in when they...
not necessarily. They may get into unsafe places like the engine, like under the hood of your car engine. Yeah. In fact, people recommend that you, if you have stray cats in your neighborhood and your car parked outside, you know, they may use that for a warm place to be, especially if the engine's still warm. Pound on the hood to prevent the cat from getting, you know, going for a ride, or worse, getting caught up in some of the mechanisms in the engine. You know, there are some of the feral cat groups do have designs for outdoor housing for cats that use, you know, coolers and hay bales and things that, if you really want to be nice, you could potentially make, you know, little kitty condos outside to keep these feral or outdoor cats. I assume they're probably owned, but, you know, if they're outside, they at least would have a warm place to be able to go.
Well, now, my two cats, Coco and Tiger, don't go outside. What about inside in the winter? I know the air gets a little drier.
Yeah, you usually, you know, most of the foods and things that you're going to be feeding your cat are, you know, they're going to have plenty of fatty acids and things to be able to keep the coat healthy. So we don't usually have to worry about things like, you know, using extra conditioners or things, because pets are going to lick them off anyways. But I think, you know, things for cats in the house, you know, I was at a, you know, one of the big box stores the other day, and they had some beautiful lilies out. And many of the lily species that are used for home decor, especially during holiday seasons, can cause kidney failure in cats if they just eat a tiny amount of them. So when you have indoor cats, it's really important to recognize, what can I decorate? What can I, you know, have that's going to be safe for my pets? You know, the old, you know, no tinsel, you know, be really careful about what ornaments and things you may hang up during the holidays. But the one plant that gets a bad rap that really doesn't cause that much trouble is the good old poinsettia. That one is actually not toxic, although it's been, over the years, promoted as being a toxic plant.
It sure has. Yeah. Oh, that's
but
good
it isn't.
To know.
No.
Good to know. Jill in Janesville has a question for you, and we'll get to Jill in just a second, but there's a line open for you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org with your question, or go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. You can go there and post. Oh, we always love to see the pet photos, too. Don't we get some great ones?
We do.
Every
we do.
Month.
Yep.
I love those pet photos. So you can post those and a question on our Facebook page. Jill in Janesville, thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a 10-year-old golden retriever that had to have surgery, and they had to shave his hindquarters. Pretty significant shave job, and he has not grown back any hair, and as winter comes, we're getting worried about about him staying warm. I'm wondering if you know what a normal hair growth period is after surgery. This is the beginning of June.
It's been since June, and he still hasn't grown hair back. Wow. One of the things that I would be looking into is to make sure that your dog doesn't have some type of endocrine or hormonal problems, such as being hypothyroid. It's a very common problem in the breed that you have. And that would be a simple blood test to be able to make sure that there isn't something like that that's delaying the regular hair growth. But hair grows in cycles, and it really depends on the breed, how they're housed, temperatures, and so on. But I would have been expecting some hair to come back, maybe a little sparse here and there. But if you're not seeing it, time to go in and have that looked at into, because, you're right. Winter's coming, and he's going to have a cold hiney.
for sure. That is for sure. He may need some covering.
But, you know, sometimes it can, depending on when they're shaved, it can sometimes take months to grow back. But it's been close to 6 months. I think it's time to investigate.
All right. Thanks, Jill.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Back to those balloon booties that you were talking about for dogs. We've had some callers wondering, where do you buy those?
Just at any pet store. Actually, I just went online and looked it up for a client the other day and just, you know, Googled dog booties, and boom, they came up. And there's a number of online pet stores and things that carry them as well.
Would they be called balloon booties?
I would just look up dog booties, and if you just click on images, they're going to come up and be right there. They've become quite popular, so they are usually one of the first ones that come up.
All right. That's Stephen Eau Claire. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Appreciate your program. Just had a question about a friend of mine has a 6-year-old Pomeranian, and recently was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. And they removed a lot of fluids and such that way. And she was down for about a day. And now coming back just a little bit, but still not a lot of not eating or anything like that. And just wondering, what are some things that we can look to do or she can look to do to help her dog that way? And, you know, they didn't really give her a time frame as far as how long she would live or anything, but they certainly said that that would probably be the cause of her death.
Yeah, so. You know, heart failure is, I mean, I'm just surprised as a six-year-old dog. I mean, it's very common in small breed dogs to have heart disease when they get older, but to be 6 years old and already diagnosed with congestive heart failure just sounds a little odd. And I don't know if they went to a cardiologist or did anything to be able to get an accurate diagnosis. But I have seen some dogs that have other things going on in the chest being misdiagnosed as heart failure, such as collapsing trachea causing a severe cough or other lung diseases and so on. So I'd just double check on that. It just sounds kind of odd to be a six-year-old dog and already in failure. But the way we manage these cases, and it is, truly just management, because we don't do heart transplants or anything like that in dogs, but we look at things like diets. There are heart diets out there that are a low salt diet that may help to prevent some of the fluid buildup. We'll often have these dogs on diuretics as well. And the problem with when we have a heart that's not pumping is, and especially with some of the drugs that we use, is we can really throw the electrolyte levels off, in particular potassium, and that can affect the appetite. So I hope that this dog is being monitored by having some blood work checked while they're on these meds to try to get the heart pumping a little bit better. There are drugs that we use that work directly on the heart as well to help improve the contractility of the heart so that it's stronger and can get that blood pumping around the body. There are drugs that we use that will help with kind of dilating the blood vessels out in the periphery so that it kind of takes some of the pressure off of the heart as well. So there's a whole host of things that we do depending on kind of the level that we're at. But I'm really concerned. 6 years old, not eating. This dog needs some extra help. Many dogs can live with proper management with heart failure for a long period of time. So I wouldn't give up yet, but maybe a second opinion's needed.
Yeah.
Would this have anything to do with the enlarged heart as well?
Yeah, well, there's a number of reasons why the heart can be enlarged. Is it the heart itself that's enlarged, or is there fluid accumulating outside of the heart in, between the sac or the pericardial sac and the heart? And sometimes that can make the heart look big on x-ray. And so this is where getting an echocardiogram or an ultrasound of the heart would really help with finding out kind of where the problem actually is and how it can be managed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good luck.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Nancy in Janesville, and she wonders if you could, Dr. Sandy, talk about mast cell tumors. I recently lost a relatively young dog to a very aggressive mast cell tumor. I knew nothing about it before my dog was diagnosed, and fear that my lack of ignorance might have cost my dog her life.
It could
have been caught earlier.
Yeah, right? It's. Please don't beat yourself up for this. I mean, cancer is one of those things that happens, and mast cell tumors are probably one of the more common skin tumors that we see in dogs, and it can also be located in other parts of the body as well, but typically they're in the skin. What these cells are, mast cells, are normally part of the body, and they're involved with things like allergic reactions. Like if you were bit by a mosquito or had a bee sting, these cells release their granules and it causes the tissue to swell and increases like the blood flow and so on to those areas. And sometimes these cells will just really start multiplying, and we can see all different grades of mast cell tumors, from ones that are relatively local, that you take wide surgical margins and they're taken care of, to a very, very aggressive ones that require, you know, often surgical intervention, chemotherapy and things to try to keep them at bay. And this is one of the things, kind of my pet peeves, is that mast cell tumors are the big impersonator of other types of tumors. And so we will have, in fact, not too long ago, I had a dog in that had lots and lots of lipomas, which are benign fatty growths. And we ended up finding 13 new, what we thought were fatty growths. But, you know, even though that's all the dogs ever had, we went ahead and we did little needle biopsies of all of these. And lucky number 13 turned out to be a mast cell tumor. And we were able to catch it early and get it removed, and the dogs never looked back. So, you know, anytime a pet has a new lump or bump, you know, don't just sit back and watch it. This should be something that gets checked out, so that if it is something more serious, early intervention may save the pet's life.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Open line for you at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right here on the Ideas Network, we're talking about probably a pet that you love. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Please join in. We've got we don't have any open lines right now, but the number is 800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page, post your pet photo, and also you can ask your questions there about your pet's health. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Linda in Fort Atkinson is up next with a question. Linda, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I started feeding some feral cats that the farmer down the road sold his property and left all of his cats there. And so I've been putting out food for them. I cannot catch any of them to see if they're spayed or neutered. And so my question is there now or in the horizon coming a medication that can prevent pregnancies that we could put in their food?
I wish it would be that easy, but no, unfortunately there isn't. I know that there's some work being done on a vaccine that would work on what's called the zona pellucida, which is part of the ovary egg development. But to my knowledge, there is nothing like a birth control thing that you can put in the food that would be considered safe for these cats. What I would recommend, though, is contacting, like, there's a group here in the Madison area called Friends of Ferals, and they do, you know, you can rent live traps so that you can actually catch these cats. They will, you know, most of the time, if they have been caught, spayed, neutered, and put back out again, they're going to have the tip of their ear missing. That's one of the things that they do to be able to, from a distance, identify these cats as being one that's already been caught. But if they've got all their ears, it's still possible that they may have been spayed or neutered. But the only way you're going to be able to tell is, you know, to actually catch them. And so look into getting live traps, and that, you know, there's a possibility these cats, if they're used to being around people, you know, with a little, you know, tender love and care, may be able to make some good pets for somebody.
Yeah.
Right. I do have live traps, and I put them up. Just darn smart cats. Tell you that we had a big Tommy that used to come in. I watched him on my security camera push the food in the can down to the edge and so he could pull it out and he never tripped the trap.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
So I called him Einstein because he's brilliant.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are coming have been, I think they're offspring of the offspring of the offspring.
Yes.
Because they're the same color. They're always coming the same place. I think Mama brings them back to me and then I feed them.
Yeah.
But it's just frustrating because I just cannot, they're smart little guys and girls and I just can't catch them.
Yeah. And you know, the big problems that I get concerned about is these animals can be a source for things like toxoplasmosis, which can contaminate your soil, other intestinal parasites like roundworms. So making sure that if, you know, they are using your yard for elimination, that you're gardening with gloves and things on. I think that's really important. And I'd also be concerned about fleas. If you've got any indoor pets, that would be something you could potentially be bringing in as well. So making sure that any of your pets are on good flea and tick control, primarily flea control, even if they're strictly indoors, because you could potentially bring those in.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Linda, for calling. Yeah, they can be a little tricky to catch.
But it may just mean that there might be different styles of cages and things that they'd be able to find. So I'd talk to friends of ferals. Yeah.
Yeah. Deb in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
Larry. I have a 5-year-old boxer mix named Ruby, who's a therapy dog. And so she's, you know, I keep her very healthy and regular vet checkups. Recently, though, she started developing a rash. First, it started on her heels and elbows, like the pressure points where she lays. It get red and puffy, kind of pimply, real itchy, and then the skin thickens and gets flaky and scabby. Well, I brought her to the vet right away, and he put her on cephalexin.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 weeks, 3 times a day, and that cleared it up. But it never went away completely. You know, it got the skin thickened and got, you know, scabby, and then it came back. So we started it again. Well, the vet also cultured the skin and found it not to be fungal. That's important for mm-hmm. her therapy dog visit, so she's not contagious or anything. But now. The vet asked me to put her on cephalexin in a pulse way, you know, 2 days on, 5 days off.
Ooh, okay.
But on the third day off, the rash came back again, and it's really bad. So now he thinks that it might be her diet. She might be allergic to something suddenly. So he has thought that it might be grain mites.
Yeah.
What do you think about?
Well, you brought up a lot of interesting things here. You know, what I get concerned about is that's a kind of an oddball spot for allergies to occur on, like, the pressure points, elbows, hocks, and so on. Stranger things have happened, but those are areas that we see scabies sometimes being the culprit, and it can be intensely itchy. You get a lot of scaling. You may get secondary infections, which is why you treat with an antibiotic. It gets better a little bit, but then it comes right back again. And so I don't know if your veterinarian has done any skin scrapings to look for these mites, which can be contagious to people. They can be intensely itchy. I, as a veterinarian for 35 years, have looked and looked and looked. These are mites that are so hard to find. Often what we have to do, because we don't find them, but we're suspicious of them, is go through a round of therapy that would be sufficient to be able to kill these mites if they happen to, you know, if they are there. And that would mean using something like Advantage Multi, Revolution. They're all kind of spot on heartworm parasiticide products that also will get scabies. And we usually treat every 2 weeks for 3 or 4 treatments to see if we can get it under control, usually at least 6 weeks. And so that might be something to consider. The other thing that concerns me is the use of the antibiotic. Yeah. When we're treating skin, cephalexin is an excellent antibiotic for most skin infections, which are usually, you know, a staph type infection. But you need to treat for at least a week post-cure. And so usually the minimum amount of time you're going to have an animal that has a chronic skin infection like this on an antibiotic would be for at least 4 weeks. Sometimes when we've got really thickened areas and it's chronic, you may be looking at 6 to 8 weeks of treatment. Mm-hmm. So that the fact that it was only used for 2 weeks, not surprised that it came back.
I want to add that I renewed the prescription. You know, he renewed it, and then I started the pulsing. So she's been on it now for about 3.5 weeks.
Okay, and the problem with this pulse therapy you're doing is you're going to be selecting for resistant bugs. In the human world, we see a lot of things called MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. In the dog world, we see that, but not as commonly as methicillin-resistant Staph pseudo-intermedius, kind of the dog's version of what people get. And so I think it would be, if you were to come in and see me, I would be doing skin scrapings looking for mites. I would be doing some cytology to see, do we really have bacteria there? If there are some pustules, especially with the therapy that's been done, I think this dog warrants a bacterial culture, not a fungal culture, looking for ringworm and things, but actually looking to see, have we got this dog on a specific antibiotic that would be effective? You'd be surprised how often we are now seeing dogs with resistant bugs, these super bugs that are really difficult to treat. Your dog's a therapy dog. It's in a hospital situation. Mm-hmm. Who knows what it could have picked up in a situation like that? So I think it's back to the drawing board again, and I would nix that pulse therapy. That is bad medicine. Sorry, veterinarian, I don't know who you are, but you know, I want to slap you on the back of the hand and say stop it, because that could be creating some of these bugs that are really, really hard to get under control.
There you go. Good luck, and thank you. So maybe get a different opinion here.
I think a second opinion is in order very quickly on this dog.
All right. Good luck, Deb. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Lynn in Milwaukee a chance to join us. Lynn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have actually a two-fold question, pretty simple stuff. I've had cats all my life. I have a 9-year-old domestic cat, and he loves milk, and he loves ice cream, and my husband loves to give it to him. Now, I've heard that milk products or dairy products are bad for cats, but it doesn't seem to bother him at all. Is it okay if he gets a treat with that? It's kind of a daily thing.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you Sawchuk's rules of sharing your food with your pet, okay? Number one, they have to be able to tolerate it, and some cats and dogs are lactose intolerant, and they can't digest it. It gives them diarrhea, so if you've got a problem like that, then obviously stop doing it, but it doesn't sound like that's an issue, but that's kind of one of the rules. And number two would be your pet needs to be normal weight. If your cat is overweight, and believe me, 50% of the patients that I see are carrying more weight than they need. Obesity in cats is at an epidemic proportion right now. And so those extra calories that are going in are probably not needed if your cat's carrying extra weight. They need to eat their regular food as well. So if they are preferentially going for the ice cream and the milk and leaving the balanced diet behind, then you may have some trouble as well. So make sure that they're eating their diet. And make sure that the cat is not being a pest. And if they are, you know, bugging your husband and, you know, meowing and headbutting him and so on, you're just kind of creating and rewarding that behavior. So if the cat is not a moocher, then by all means, continue to do it. But if you break any of those rules, then that would be something that you can tell your husband, stop it. Okay. So,
and I'm wondering too about the type of ice cream. Now, is chocolate a problem for cats?
There's like probably not. Yeah. There's probably not enough chocolate in there to cause any trouble. Okay. I mean, cats and dogs can be very sensitive to it, but it's not like, you know, eating a chocolate bar or something.
Okay.
I mean, it's potentially you could, if you had like a big, you know, bunch of chocolate, or it was like a chocolate chip type ice cream or something, but you do have to be careful.
Okay, yep. There we go. Thanks, Lynn. Thank you very much for calling.
Got me hungry now.
Yeah, I know, and I'm thinking ice cream. Boy, that'd be good right
even
about,
on this
huh?
cold day. I know. Yeah.
Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
My daughter has her third Great Pyrenees, who's now 6 years old. The other two have already died of cancer. This one here also has cancer. Is there something in the breed or... And how far do you go? She's now talking. The dog has the cancer started, I guess, in the leg.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of pain, and she's given a pain medication on that. And she has a vet, of course, and she's thinking about taking this dog over to Madison to see if there's something else that can be done for this animal with the cancer.
Yeah.
What the heck is going on with... I'm thinking that part of the problem is that these dogs are so inbred, and she gets them from rescue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, we know that one of the leading causes of death in large breed dogs is cancer. It's kind of, you know, when you start looking, there was a study done on causes of death, and small breed dogs tended to die more of kidney disease, heart failure, and so on when they got older. Large breed dogs, cancer. So we do know that it can run in certain breeds and families, and certain even some dogs even have breeds have even certain types of cancer that tend to be more prevalent, like flat-coated retrievers get sarcomas, and you know, golden retrievers, well, they get almost every type of cancer, but we see a lot of them with lymphoma and problems that way. Boxers get a lot of skin cancers, like mast cell tumors that we talked about earlier on the show. And it's just, you know, when you have a breed that you really like, it's almost one of those things that you have to do your homework. And if she's going through a rescue group, you're not going to be able to look back and say, how long did the grandparents live, and look back multiple generations. And so, you know, is it inbreeding? Well, anytime you've got any purebred dog, I mean, the genetic pool is a lot smaller than it is in, you know, mixed breed dogs. But, and then, you know, how far do you go with cancer? It sounds like it may be bone cancer. If the dog is in pain, you know, amputating the leg is not going to provide longevity, but it will get rid of the source of pain. We see a lot of three-legged dogs in our clinic. And then there are different chemotherapy regimens that can be done to be able to provide the dog with a good quality of life for longer than they would have without chemotherapy. And this would be the kind of thing that would be discussed with the oncologist. They'd be able to give you percentages as to if we do this and only do surgery, how long they live, or if we, you know, add this chemotherapy in, here's how long, like, on average they can live. And again, you know, it's all a personal choice as to whether the dog is capable of going and the owner is capable of doing that for their pet. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Nancy.
Very sorry that your grand dog is, you know, having so much trouble.
Do you think that maybe those dogs are bred, they're supposed to be outside in the snow, up the mountains, chasing a sheep or whatever, and when an animal like that that's used to, that's really naturally an outdoors animal,
mm-hmm.
and then it's in the house when you've got carpeting and all these different kind of chemicals in your interior home, that maybe this is not good.
Yeah, you know, but you know, with so many breeds of dogs are so far removed from what their ancestors had them, you know, what they did, that I really don't know. I mean, yes, they're always, you know, in the environment, there's things that can affect us, can affect our pets. But I think it's just luck of the draw that you've got a breed that is, you know, they're a large breed dog. They get a lot of cancers, and it's unfortunate. I mean, I love the English Bulldog, but I haven't had one live past 9 years of age. And it's heartbreaking, but, you know, that's one of those things that you accept when you have a breed that you're really fond of.
Nancy, thanks again for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Linda in Egg Harbor a chance to join us. Linda, hello to you.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a 2-year-old male neutered cat who is healthy. But about 4 weeks ago, he started sneezing just continually, even though he didn't really seem sick at all. And then the sneezing subsided. And now, in the last 5 days, he's had this, I don't know what to call it, but an inner eyelid that's kind of white coming out of the corners of his eyes that are protruding
out over the eyeball, and with a little bit of redness. And I live on a farm, and I have cats on the farm, and I had some erythromycin. And I've been treating that like for conjunctivitis, although there's nothing running, there's no discharge, there's no pus. Mm-hmm. I was reading online and they said that one vet said that it can be caused by internal parasites and in the intestinal tract. So I wormed him with Dronsal Feline about 4 days ago, but it doesn't seem to be responsive to the erythromycin, and he's showing no other symptoms. I mean, he's running around, playing, eating, acting normally.
Yeah, yeah. What you're describing is, if you look up a condition that I think in kind of the old-time veterinary literature, you'll have it referred to as Haws, H-A-W-S. It's protrusion of the third eyelid, and one of the thoughts was that it potentially it could be due to intestinal parasites or something. There are some other neurologic problems that can cause that third eyelid to come up. There's a condition called Horner's syndrome, which is involvement of one of the nerves that provides innervation to the eye that can sometimes be either temporarily or permanently affected. When I've seen cats that have this, especially young, active cats, especially if they've been feline leukemia and FIV tested negative, many of them will, it's more cosmetic at this point, and eventually it goes away. It can last for sometimes several weeks, but if there isn't any underlying cause that can be found, the corneas look healthy, there's nothing to make the cat be wanting to pull that eyeball back in the socket. Neurologically, they're normal. They don't have any other infectious diseases. You've dewormed them. Then it's a matter of just sitting back and waiting and seeing, because it's something that we see, but we don't have a good explanation for.
No.
I see. So you don't think it's related to the sneezing a few weeks ago?
It may have been, and that's why I think it's important that you have your cat checked, because cat herpes or rhinotracheitis can sometimes start out with respiratory signs and then progress to involving the eyes, and sometimes we can see some corneal involvement that can make the eyes painful, and so the eye gets pulled back in the socket and the third eyelid comes up, and if you're just popping antibiotics in, it's not going to help if it's a virus cause. So I'd be taking your kitty into a veterinarian and just make sure that that's all, everything else is normal. If they can't find any other reason, then just sit back and wait, and it should get better on its own.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thank you, Linda, for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She usually comes by the second Tuesday of the month. And so just thinking ahead here, your next visit will be December 9th, if I'm not mistaken. But great to have you here now.
Nice to be here.
Yep. Yeah, it's great to have you here. And Susan in Madison has a question for you, so let's go to her. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy. I have a border mix that has, really thick, fluffy hair between her toes, and she loves to play outside and, until she gets the inevitable snowballs. So I'm wondering, what is the veterinary verdict on trimming hair and how deep or what's the...
To get those snowballs out from between the...
Yeah. If the hair is really long, you can get little, mini clippers that can get in there, and you can get all that hair trimmed away. The risk with using scissors is actually cutting the skin, and so you'd have to be careful if you are going to be using scissors. You may want to consider just periodically taking your dog to a professional groomer to have the feet trimmed. A lot of people do that, and it's done, it's easy, they're up on a table, they're not going to be fighting you, and there's no questions asked. They just are able to get it done, and so that might be an inexpensive way of being able to keep your dog comfortable during the winter. I'd be looking at a good hair trim.
There you go.
Okay, so it is okay to do.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't be shaving the rest of the body down, but I think for feet, yes. I think it just becomes a functional thing having all that hair there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks.
How often do you have any idea how often groomers are bitten by dogs or cats?
I don't know, but there was a study looking at veterinary technicians, and I don't have the article with me right now, but I was absolutely shocked to see how many vet technicians are injured in the line of duty. It was a study out of Minnesota, and it's each technician had like 6 injuries a year or something like that. It was just unbelievable that, you know, that they're getting bit and scratched and so on.
Yep. I remember one of my former cats put one of your techs in the hospital.
Yep. And that can happen because cat bite wounds get infected very, very easily.
Yeah. Dorothy in Green Bay, thanks for calling. Hi. Oh, you know what, Dorothy, before we get to you, since there was another question relating to the weather. So hold on, Dorothy. We'll be right there. I did want to get this in from Amanda, who has a new puppy, a Shorkie, who is 8 months old, potty trained, great, doing great outside, concerned about these winter months going outside on the snow and ice. We have a fenced-in deck area off our garage we don't use, and I'm wondering, for those super cold, snowy days, is it okay to put out a paper on the deck for him to go on, or is that a bad idea? I've heard of putting sod in a cat box and have the dog go in there.
Yeah, you know, those are things that we always have to consider. Is dogs learn surface preference. Their preferred thing to eliminate on by the time they're about 7 weeks of age. And that doesn't mean that it's going to be cast in stone, that they only want to go on grass or whatever. But it just, if that is available, that's what they're going to want to use. Cats and dogs are totally different species, and obviously cats like to dig in a substrate, and so you can provide them with a litter box with litter in it, and most cats will find it and use it. If not, they'll find your house plants or something else. It's equally good for digging and burying. For dogs, if your dog is used to going on the grass, the sod business isn't a bad idea. They actually do make like indoor potty systems for dogs that have things like AstroTurf on it, with, you know, that makes it easier to wash and to take care of. You may want to look into some of those systems. But generally, you know, having just an area where the snow's been shoveled, the dog goes out, does their business, and comes right back in again, they're not going to freeze in that very, very short period of time. They may hold it a little bit longer, but, I just, you know, say just shovel a spot, and they will take care of their business if they have to go.
Speaking of outdoors, Karen posted on our Facebook page a nice photo of Maddie, the snow queen, a yellow lab, 10 years old, looking pretty regal there.
Yeah, look at that deep snow, though. I know.
But looking reasonably happy being out there.
Yeah, she's got a head collar on, which is one of those, it's not a muzzle, but it's one of those things that's, if they're a real heavy-duty puller, it makes it a little bit easier. You have control over their head.
Gentle leader?
A gentle leader, yeah.
That's what they're called, I believe, yeah. Let's now go to Dorothy in Green Bay. Dorothy, thanks for waiting.
I have a cat that's about 11 years old and weighs about 10 pounds. And about 5 weeks ago, I was combing her fur or hair, and I noticed she has fleas. I've been treating her with Frontline, but I still see 2 or 3 fleas every time I comb her hair. What would you suggest?
Well, the fleas that you're finding on your cat today were from eggs that were laid 2 months ago. All right. So this is not something that you're going to get under control overnight. It will often take 2 or 3 months to be able to eradicate the fleas that are in the environment that are going to reinfect your cat again. Good for you for putting on a good flea adulticide. And that will, you're probably finding fleas that have not had the opportunity to die yet. So it's not that the product is failing. It's just pretty normal for new fleas to jump up, and you're catching those things. What you can do in your house is really thorough vacuuming of you know, any place where the cat likes to lay, like baseboards, under the couch, between the cushions of the couch, to get as many of those flea eggs and larvae and the flea droppings, the pre-digested blood that the adult fleas are leaving behind, vacuumed up, so that, again, you're going to decrease the environmental load. But I would be, you know, just recommending that for at least 3 months, if not longer, you keep, you know, a good adulticide on your pet to be able to keep those fleas from being able to feed again and then, you know, start laying more eggs. It's also important that when you are using a flea product, that you look for something that is not just something that's going to kill adults, but also contains something called an insect growth regulator. You're going to find products that are called like Methoprene, Precor is another one, a brand name. There's several of them on the market, and that would be like Frontline Plus. Many of the generic Fipronil or like the Frontline knockoff products do not have that in it. And that way, if an adult flea happens to get up and feeds before they die and are able to lay eggs, those eggs will not hatch. So you're going to be breaking the cycle that way as well. So double check the product you're using and just give it time.
There you go.
Another thing is, well, I have guests that come and bring their dog, and you know I like that too, but will the fleas be attracted to a dog?
Oh, definitely. Even though the main flea that we see on dogs and cats is called the cat flea, that is the one that we see, like 95% of the fleas on dogs are actually the cat flea. So you should be right up front with anybody that visits with their pet. That may be how your cat got fleas in the first place, that they had a visitor that had cat or, you know, a pet with fleas. The fleas laid eggs. That pet left, and then those fleas went on to develop and turn into, you know, the colony that you're currently dealing with. So warn your friends that if they're going to bring their pet over, it should be on some type of flea control, since they have a risk of bringing them home to their own house.
There you go. Thanks, Dorothy. Tammy in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. A few weeks ago, I had picked out a kitten. A woman found a litter of kittens outside of her house, and they were being attacked by ducks, and so they're very pitiful. And I picked, we picked out a little guy, and he was super sweet, and I brought him home and kept him away from my cats for the day and took him to the vet, and he was about 6 weeks old and had him tested, and he was tested positive for feline leukemia. And the young woman who found the kittens took him back, and she's going to get them retested in about December. And I'm just curious what the chances are of a false positive with feline leukemia.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what we are testing for is it is actually part of the organism. It's an antigen test. And so when we see that, it's possible some cats that get exposed when they're young are able to fight it off and revert to a negative status. So it's not truly a false, it's possible to be a false positive, but it's also most likely that the cat did come in contact with it from its mom, being an outdoor cat. And there's a possibility, I mean, I wouldn't think it's a death sentence yet, but I'd be rechecking that cat and making sure that it is staying positive. There's a couple of other there's another test that you can do that it, besides the little snap test, you may want to look at sending a blood sample off to an outside lab to have that looked at as well. And that may just, again, help with confirming whether the little kitty does have this disease. But good for you for keeping this cat separated from your cats before you let them mingle.
Yeah.
Because, boy, that would have been a nightmare if this cat truly does have leukemia.
And now, if the cat would come back and test negative, is that a for sure thing? Or would that also be kind of like you would need to get it retested again? Or
Yeah,
I mean, typically we test when they're kittens and then we retest again when they're about 6 months of age. And that's primarily because what we're testing for in with these little snap tests is not only feline leukemia, but FIV, which is the other a kind of immunosuppressant virus that cats can be exposed to. And we see a lot of, you know, of ambiguous results with that in young cats with the FIV part. But I would be making sure that you've got at least two tests 6 months apart that are negative.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Tammy, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Judy and Lodi a chance to join us. Judy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. It's Dr. Sandy. I have a Maine Coon cat that was given to me, and he's about 6 years old. I just was able to save enough money to get some shots for him. But unfortunately, now I'm disabled and I can't get out. But he has got, I don't know, he's not eating his normal soft food.
Mm-hmm.
He'll eat his dry food, but not the soft food. And do you think it could be the food? Or something else?
Yeah, you know, if cats had their ways, most cats prefer wet food over dry because it's tastier, it's got a better odor and so on. As long as he is eating and he's active and he's playful and he's using his litter box and he's not vomiting or having diarrhea, he's urinating fine, but he's, you know, eating plenty of his dry food to be able to maintain his weight, it's probably nothing. He's probably just going through a little finicky stage. Maybe they changed the formulation of the candy, doesn't like it as much, and it may not be anything. But if anything else is different, like he is more lethargic, or maybe he's just having the odd nibble of dry food and not taking in enough to be able to support himself, boy, you know, he really needs to be seen. And there, you know, I would be contacting your local shelters. I know that even like at the veterinary school, we have not always, but usually some funding for people that are unable to provide for, you know, an emergency situation like that, if someone that is in need. So we do have, you know, there are things like that that are out there that, so, you know, don't be, you know, just saying, I can't do anything. There may be somebody that could help you.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, that's what worries me. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And should a 12-year-old cat, Linda wonders in an email, who suffered a broken tooth, less than a half a centimeter broken off straight across, always have the tooth removed? The tooth is one of the top longer teeth.
Yeah, that's if it's a canine tooth, the problem is if you remove that upper one, the lower canine may actually hit the lip and start causing some troubles because that upper one acts as a brace. So we try to maintain them if we can. Root canals are always possible. So, but that would depend on the health of that tooth and whether it is something that could be salvaged.
All right. And we have Maddie. Oh, we showed that nice picture of Maddie the Snow Queen. And we have a under our posts on our Facebook page, a very cute photo from Karen of a little kitty. And I haven't gotten it up yet here, but I'm going to get it up. And we are also going to be taking more calls and questions and comments. Certainly, you can join in with yours at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Another one of those great photos on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Sandy will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and then we'll be right back. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and thank you so much for listening in and for calling in. The number to call if you have a question about your pet's health, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Title of that page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Leona in Union Center has been holding on for a while here, Sandy, so let's go to her. Leona, thank you for calling.
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, I have this 14-year-old black cat, and he's got a very terrible urinary problem. And I'll confess something, I do Reiki, and I've gotten him where he's lively and alert, and he wants to be brushed again, but he urinates such huge amounts, and the veterinary told me they must have a urine sample to really check it if it's diabetes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a terrible job with another cat. I said, how in the world can I collect it? And they said, well, put a big piece of plastic into the litter pan and probably catch it. But is there some other way we could test him
for
diabetes?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways we can do this, and I would be also concerned about things like kidney failure as
yes.
well, because that can happen in cats as they get older. We collect urine two ways in cats. One of them is to collect it directly from the bladder, doing a procedure called cystocentesis, which is taking a little needle in through the abdominal wall into the bladder and aspirating urine out. Obviously, this would not be something you would do at home. It would have to be done at your vet clinic, but you get a sterile sample that can be then used for culture and checking for, you know, if kidney failure, diabetes, and so on. The other thing is checking with your veterinarian regarding non-absorbent cat litters. There is some litters available that are usually like little plastic pellets or a kind of a hydrophobic sand that does not absorb moisture. And it would mean that your kitty would have to be isolated from your other cat. You would replace the litter in the litter box with a small amount of this non-absorbent cat litter and keep them confined with the litter box until they go to the bathroom. And then you suck the urine up in a syringe or something and then take it into your vet clinic to have it evaluated. So those are really the only two ways that I know of to be able to safely get a urine sample from a cat. Obviously, you can catheterize them too, but that requires either sedation or anesthesia to be able to do that. But the collecting at home with the non-absorbent litter is actually quite easy.
There we go.
Well, I think my doctor, she's very elderly now, but wonderful doctor. Everybody loves her, Dr. Birch.
Oh, good, good.
And she, but I don't think she does that type of thing. The only thing that they told me there at the office, I would have to put a plastic into the box and hoping that he would urinate it and then catch the urine and put it in the refrigerator.
Well, that, I mean, that's possible, but, you know, again, you'd have to keep him isolated from your other cat, and it may or may not work, but, yeah.
There you go.
Good luck.
Thank you, Leona, for calling. Appreciate it. And Dave and Monona, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm fortunate. I have a very healthy cat, but he was a rescue cat that I got as companion for an older female, and she passed in the first part of September. I let him see her body, and let him become familiar with the idea that she wasn't going to be around. He was a quiet cat, unassuming, no trouble, absolutely normal cat.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, he has not a howl, but a constant meow every moment that he's awake. I've palpated his abdomen. He has no response as if to pain. His urine and he keeps everything else is working fine.
Yeah.
The only other odd thing that he's done, again, he just had no quirky habits before, but now he chooses to stand in his water.
Weird.
And he's fascinated by water in the tub and in the toilet, and he never had those things before her passing.
Very strange.
I hate to anthropomorphize a cat, but 2 months seems like a long time for mourning, and I can't understand the fascination with water. I just wonder if there's something else I should be looking at.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange. We do sometimes see cats really take it hard when they've lost a housemate, and especially if that cat was the one that initiated, okay, let's go, you know, get dinner, let's, you know, wander over here and look out the window, and he just kind of followed that one around, then, you know, he may be really lost because he just doesn't know how to live without having another cat around. I mean, does that mean that you need to get another cat? Potentially. I would make sure that if you are going to be doing that, that you introduce them very slowly, because even though he enjoyed the company of your cat that you lost, he may not approve of having another one brought into the household. I'd get him checked out by your veterinarian to make sure that there isn't anything physically wrong with him. To give you an example, I had a very astute owner who said their cat was just wandering and kind of following them around the house, and they'd never done that before. Just constant, like just walking wherever they were, the cat would just be pacing and following them and didn't seem to settle down. And on further evaluation, we ended up finding out that the cat had a large brain tumor that was affecting the cat's behavior. It was still eating. It was still able to use the litter box, but it's just mentation was kind of off. And I'm hoping, you know, that is not what's going on with your cat. But I think just making sure you get to the bottom that there's nothing physically going on. The standing in the water is just bizarre.
Weird. Yeah,
very weird. I can see, you know, licking out the shower and doing, but to actually stand in their water dish, that's very strange behavior.
Yeah, very strange. Dave, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. We turn to Pam from the Upper Peninsula next, the UP. Thank you, Pam, for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
We are still mourning the loss of our four-year-old pug, who we had to euthanize on the 15th of October for suspected pug-dog encephalitis.
Mm-hmm.
He started with seizures towards the end of July, and they were clusters, and then he had it again the end of August, and then a couple of weeks later, he had ended up being put on three different anticonvulsants, and he wasn't tolerating them. And
oh boy!
He ended up going into cluster seizures, and
there
was just nothing more we could do for him. And
mm-hmm.
he was just the most happiest, alive little guy. And I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional.
No, but you know what? Right. I totally. I mean, this is one of these diseases. We call it pug dog encephalitis, PDE. We don't know what causes it. There really isn't any treatment. They are managed sometimes with, at least for some of them, they may be able to tolerate some anticonvulsants. Some of them, if they've got some brain swelling, may respond to things like some steroids. But it is a fatal disease. And I wish we knew what was causing it, but it is one of those things that it's an idiopathic disease that has, you know, we need to know more about it, but unfortunately we don't. And it does hit them at that point where they're young and vital. If it was when they were really old, you know, they've had a good life. But these dogs, when they're in their, you know, just a few years of age and they're developing this progressive, non-treatable neurologic problem, it is just heartbreaking. And I'm so sorry for you, but unfortunately, you know, ending your dog's life, it was inevitable, especially with that particular disease.
Yeah.
Well, sorry. I just wanted to say thank you because he got, a few years ago, we took him to your hospital, to the vet school, from the UP because he had good issues with his palate and everything. And you guys fixed him up good. And if it weren't for this, I was real confident that he would have a normal life expectancy.
No,
because of the care he got from you guys. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
and again,
you.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Yeah, very much so.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Pam. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, those are sad times. My next email is from Sally, who said the 14-year-old black lab had what we thought was a stroke, but talked to our vet who believed it to be vestibular syndrome. What can you tell me about it, and what can I do for her? She was feeling better within 4 hours.
Well, this is a very common problem in older dogs. In fact, we even call it old dog vestibular disease. And it comes on very quickly. The dog will be normal one moment and then all of a sudden doing, you know, rolling on the floor, maybe vomiting. Their eyes are flicking back and forth in their face. They may have a head tilt. Within a few days, they start to get better again. I'm surprised that it was only 4 hours for this dog. But, generally, vascular accidents or strokes are fairly uncommon in dogs. And so when we get an older animal in like this where it comes on acutely, you can go through a full neurologic exam and you end up just localizing the problem to the balance apparatus in the ear. And we see this in cats as well, where it just comes on acutely. The best thing you can do is just supportive care, getting them on anti-nausea drugs because they feel like they're on the tilt-a-whirl, making sure that they're not near stairs or anything where they can hurt themselves, and then they get better. But she may get it again. Don't be surprised if it happens again. Some dogs will have recurrent episodes of it.
Tony in Mount Horeb, thanks for calling. Hello.
Good morning. Thank Dr. Sawchuk for all her help. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you have any update or thoughts about the Seresto collars for cats. in that our cat practice practitioner kind of poo-pooed it a year or so ago, and if it's been more proven now. And does that control also the growth-regulating part of the flea cycle?
Yeah, I really like this Seresto collar. It has two different chemicals in it for fleas, and it does work for fleas and ticks in cats. And with ticks being never really being a huge issue, cats seem to be more resistant to things like Lyme disease, unlike dogs. We never were that concerned about tick control in cats, but now with the Lone Star tick coming up into our state carrying a disease called cytozoonosis that can be fatal for cats, I think it's really important to make sure that we are using flea and tick control. I have many clients that use them. They're very safe. It does not, to my knowledge, have an insect growth regulator in it, but it does have one of the chemicals is a very rapid kill so that it kills the fleas before they have a chance to start laying eggs. But I may be wrong. I have to check on that. But I've been very happy with them, and they last for 8 months, so you can put it on and forget about it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Really nice.
And it gives you more constant flea protection rather than the topical.
Even the topicals, by the time you get to the end of the month, they're still pretty effective. So I think using either one, I think that the Seresto collar, it's if your cat wears a collar and doesn't mind it, by all means, 8 months, it's economical. And because cats aren't swimming or being bathed as often as dogs are, you do get the 8 months of protection from it. For dogs that are doing a lot of swimming, it can drop the efficacy down to about 5 months. So, but I really like them.
All right, there we go. Thanks, Tony, for calling. Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Say hi to Pete.
Okay.
I've got two questions. I have a six-year-old chow. I live where there are possums. Any kind of wild animal that you can imagine along a creek. Is there anything extra that he would have to have protection from? My vet, I get rabies, I get all the other things. Mm-hmm. Then the other question is, being a chow, I just recently read, I should have known it before, a blue-tongued dog could get cancer on his tongue, and he has a spot on it. My vet is coming. Should I call attention to that?
Yeah. Well, let's answer the question first about vaccinations. I'm glad that you're getting your dog vaccinated for all the standard things. The one extra thing I would make sure that your dog is inoculated for on an annual basis is for a disease called leptospirosis. It is spread through the urine of wildlife. You've got a stream in your yard. It likes to live in kind of damp areas and water areas because of the nature of the bacteria. It can cause liver and kidney failure in dogs. And so with your dog, I hope that your dog is being vaccinated for that. And again, because of the wildlife situation, and it sounds like it's a pretty nice area that could have a lot of tick issues, I'd talk to your veterinarian about vaccinating for Lyme disease as well.
Yeah, he's vaccinated for Lyme, and I have HeartGuard.
Good.
That he is given.
Yeah, and make sure, because possums are actually the number one transmitter of fleas into your yard. I mean, we do know that raccoons and possums are probably the top two animals that carry the cat flea and deposit those larvae or eggs in the yard, and then your pet goes out there and picks them up. Make sure that you do keep them on a good flea and tick control and pretty much year round, because we need in our state pretty much year round tick control. There's some times where it's really cold and ticks are going to be hiding under the snow crust, but other times, they even with snow on the ground, they'll come out. Your question regarding are chows at increased risk of oral cancer because they have a hyperpigmented tongue, the purpley kind of dark tongue? I don't know, but we do see oral melanomas in pets are really nasty. Usually when we've got a melanoma on the skin, the majority of those tend to be more benign. We do sometimes see malignant melanomas, but it's not that common. But when we get a melanoma in the mouth, that's usually bad news for the pet. So if you do see something abnormal on your dog's tongue, by all means, point it out to your veterinarian. Sometimes if you can catch things early, it's going to give you a much better prognosis.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Jackie. Thanks for calling. And Bill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I have about a 10-year-old black lab, and on his hindquarters, each hip, there's just like tufts of hair that you can reach down and just pull out with your finger. You can see where it's kind of hanging there and just pull it right out in clumps.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what the problem was there.
It probably is just the shedding. And sometimes as dogs get older, their shedding may be a little bit different than when they were younger. And you can get more clumping like that, like you're describing. But if the skin is normal and you're not seeing actually areas where there is hair loss, it's just the undercoat kind of coming out in clumps, I'd recommend getting a good brush like the Furminator or a good metal comb to be able to get in there and get all that hair out of there. It'll make your dog look better and your house will stay cleaner.
There you go. Thanks, Belle. Thanks for calling. Boy, we have lots of email questions and Facebook things as well. Julie posted on our Facebook page, sort of in response to you were talking about outdoor shelters for neighborhood strays, cats, and so forth. And she has a super easy, cheap one to try, and the cats love it, apparently. And she posts the how-to right on our Facebook page.
Yeah, and it's using the plastic storage bin with a hole cut in it and then an insulating styrofoam cooler and some straw and things in there. And there's lots of different designs like that out there. But, boy, that would be a nice cozy spot for a cat to get out of the cold.
Absolutely. Email from Jason, who's been feeding their 45-pound dog a heaping spoonful of canned pumpkin with some dry food for breakfast daily for about 2 years. As we heard, it's beneficial and gets her to eat. Is this okay, and is the amount okay? Curious about long-term feeding, but she asks for it every morning.
Well, it's kind of an odd thing that the dog really likes it that much, but it's not going to hurt the dog. We use pumpkin and recommend that pumpkin be added to food sometimes if we need some extra fiber. That sometimes helps keep pets a little more regular. And if the dog likes it, it's an inexpensive fiber source and probably adding a little extra vitamin A to your dog's diet, but not enough to throw off the balance. So go for it.
Go for it. Email from Kath. I have an 8-month-old female golden doodle. I'd like to get spayed. I'm struggling with at what age. I've heard very strong arguments on when it's best, everything from the sooner the better to not before 2 years. You know, what about bone growth and mammary tumors, you know, that sort of hormonal imbalances, all kinds of things.
Yeah, you know, there's some good research that has come out from UC Davis looking at golden retrievers and Labrador retrievers. And so whether, you know, the fact that now we've got this, you know, golden doodle type thing, whether it's, adding in poodle there too, it may make the results be a little bit different. But what they're finding is that if they are spayed after a year of age, they have fewer problems with some of the common orthopedic diseases like ruptured anterior cruciate ligaments that can occur. I think that I would be strongly recommending that you talk to your veterinarian and, you know, do your homework. Kind of our classic time of neutering them is before they come into heat. And obviously, if you wait until they're over a year of age, there's a possibility that they'll have a heat cycle that will very small increase. There might be a very small increase in the risk of breast cancer after one heat cycle, but it usually takes a couple of heat cycles before the damage has been done. So I'm, you know, leaning if, you know, you can be a responsible owner, large breed dog. Boy, I'm going to be having a lot of veterinarians out there going, what are you saying? But, you know, looking at this, I'd be like, yeah, let's see if we can stretch it and maybe do it when she's closer to a year of age rather than doing it when they're younger.
And a Facebook comment from Mary: after an expensive emergency vet visit, I'd like to remind people of the dangers of xylitol. Our granddaughter had a full package of gum in her backpack, and our pug sniffed it out and shared or ate some of it. And we have to do follow-ups, blood work, and they're on liver support,
both of them.
Yeah,
you know, so xylitol is in a lot of different products that we ingest, including sugar-free gum. And in dogs, the big problem is that it drops their blood sugar rapidly and can cause liver failure. And it is an emergency. And so I am so sorry that you ran into that. But thank goodness you've got a ER clinic nearby that saved your dog's life.
And with that, we are out of time. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And you're back on December 9th.
Yes, my daughter's 22nd birthday.
Ooh, okay. I know. Yeah. A great day to celebrate. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Vet Medicine. And certainly we'll have her back, and it'll be on December 9th. Tomorrow we'll talk about how Wisconsin residents were involved in the movement to ban DDT. Thank you all for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.